And as usual, we are all gathered here today to listen to another exposition of the Lord Buddha's Dhamma. And before we commence today's sermon, let us all take a moment to remind ourselves of how extremely fortunate we are to be his students, his disciples. And we all know that I speak of no other than the perfect one, he who is perfect in virtue, he who is perfect in compassion, he who is perfect in his concentration, in effort, in vigor, in vigilance, in victory, in wisdom. I speak of none other than the merciful one, the undefeated one, the unvanquished one. Of course, I could go on. So let us take a moment to pledge our allegiance to him as his disciples, and by pledging our allegiance, he expects nothing else from us than for us to follow his teaching and to achieve our liberation, to fulfill that which we have come into this world for. So, this is what we promise ourselves. This is in fact a solemn oath that we take upon ourselves as we make this pledge of allegiance to the Lord Buddha. So, let us all then be upstanding to recite the Dhirasavikata Mohasa stanzas and to pledge that we are disciples of the Lord Buddha.
Dhirasa vigata mohasa abhinnakhilasa vijita vijayasa anighasa susamachittasa tantarasa vimalasa bhagavatotasa savakohamasmi. Sokamisasa muditasa katasamanasa manujasa antimasarirasa narasa anupamasa virajasa bhagavatotasa savakohamasmi. Asansayasa kulasa venaikasa saratiwarasa anuttarasa ruchiradhammasa nikhankasa pabhasakarasa manachidasa virasa bhagavatotasa savakohamasmi. Nisabhasa appamiyasa gambhirasa monapattasa khemankarasa vedasa dhammattasa bhagavatotasa savakohamasmi. Nisabhasa appamiyasa gambhirasa monapattasa khemankarasa vedasa dhammattasa sanguttattasa sangatigasa muttasa bhagavatotasa savakohamasmi. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa.
And now, to observe the precepts, let us all take a moment to seek refuge first in the Noble Triple Gem, and in order to do so, please repeat all together and after me.
Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Saraṇāgamanaṃ sampunnaṃ. Pānādipātā vēramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Adinnādāna vēramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Kāmesu micchācārā vēramani sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Papadang samadhiyami. Surameraya matthana veramani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Tisara sampade tabbang.
Okay, you may all now be seated. Also, before we commence today's sermon, let us all take a moment to invite all the celestial beings in this 10,000 world systems. As among them will be those we will have come along with in this infinitely long journey in samsara. And on virtually all occasions we met, they would have path of righteousness. Among them will be our parents in our previous births, siblings, teachers, best of friends. It is today that we have the opportunity to help and support them in ways which we can today never imagine, in ways which we never have been able to help them previously. And that is because today we have the gift of Dhamma. We are about to pass on the gift of Dhamma to them. And among them will be those who are today born in woeful plains, and to them we shall offer this opportunity to rejoice in merits, in the hope that such merits will help them to redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane, and then following on from that, to attain the blissful states of Nibbana. So, as I now make this invitation out to all those celestial beings, I ask you to extend that invitation out in your hearts and in your minds, reminding yourselves of how grateful we ought to be towards them. And therefore, with compassion towards all of them, extend this invitation out in your hearts and in your minds. Invite them to join us invite them to witness this meritorious deed, to acquire merits, in the hope that such merits help them to be born in the blissful plane, and free themselves from the woeful plane, and in the hope that such merits will help them to listen to the teaching of the Buddha, and that they'll be able to understand and comprehend it, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana.
Samanta chakravalesu atra gacchantu devata saddhammam munirajasa sunantu saggamokkhadam dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta Dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta Dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta
Let us also take a moment to seek forgiveness from the Noble Triple Gem, the Aryans, as well as the Sambuddha Shasana. For in this long journey in samsara, we have not always had the opportunity to associate with moral and noble people. Virtually all our associations have been with ignoble, immoral people, and such associations defiled our minds with raga, dvesha and moha, desire, aversion and delusion, and having been blinded with ignorance and attachment, countless times we will have offended them, insulted them, neglected them, revile them. The consequences of such actions are that today, as we make efforts to achieve our salvation, these efforts are hindered and it becomes incredibly difficult for us to attain our Nibbana. Therefore, let us all take a moment to seek forgiveness from the Noble Ones, including the Samma Sambuddhas, the Paccheka Buddhas, Arahata Buddhas, Anagami, Sakradagami, Sotapanna, Spide on the path of having attained the fruits, as well as the Buddha's ministry, the Sambuddha Shasana. And as you take this moment to seek forgiveness, I remind you all to make a firm resolve to never conduct yourself in such manner henceforth. Okay, and finally, let us all make a firm resolve. May through the course of this sermon, if thus far there have remained gaps in our understanding, in our knowledge, in our comprehension, which have kept us from freeing ourselves, and have kept us bound to the woeful planes, then may through the course of this sermon, such barriers be lifted, such gaps in our knowledge be fulfilled, our understanding be fulfilled, and may we be able to free ourselves from the four great hells once and for all. And for those among you who may have already achieved the first noble attainment of Sotapanna, may through the course of this sermon you be able to fulfill the subsequent stages, and may we all be able to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. With that resolve deep-seated in your mind, I now invite you all to prepare yourselves to listen to this sermon. So I'm sure and I'm certain that you're all making your best efforts on a regular basis. I hope I'm right in saying on a daily basis. And one day I hope I'll be right in saying on an hourly basis. Every minute. And potentially one day every second. And then following on from that all the time. You are mindful. You are vigilant. You are careful of the thoughts that pass through your mind. You don't let opportunities pass you by. You examine them. You have dropped the telescope and you have picked up the microscope. With a fine-tooth comb, you go through each and every one of your thoughts, at least the ones which you are sensitive to, and you examine them, you scrutinize them, so that you can be freed. Freedom has to be the ultimate goal here. Nibbana is another word for freedom. There was once a time when we all thought to ourselves that freedom is something that others have to give us. So people fought for their freedom, and they continue to do so. Among them, we have ranked in the past. We fought for our freedom. At various points in the history of mankind, various years, various decades, will be written in blood red. Blood red because people have shed blood, sweat and tears in the fight for freedom. And people will do so in the future. That will always continue. Among them will have been you and I. So it is not for us to say that any of that is wrong necessarily. However, once we have embarked on the path of liberation that the Buddha taught us, we realize that a greater war happens always within our minds. We realize that we need to wage war not outside but on the inside. That the battle for freedom, the battle for liberation is one that happens on the inside. This is a very spiritual pursuit, a spiritual affair. So once we have realized that, folks, little do we care about the shortcomings that are presented to us from the outside world. The things that other people say to us or don't say to us. The things that other people do to us or don't do to us. What we have or what we don't have on the outside has little bearing, has little significance. Like a swing which goes up and down, there was once a time when the aforementioned things took a prime place in our lives. They were very important to us. And by us, you know, I mean all of us. Those who have come in the past, those who are here today, and those who will join our ranks in the future. Because this is a silent army. We don't shout a lot. I'd like to say we don't talk a lot, but I still have to do the sermons. But even when we do talk, they're not complaints about the things we don't have. They're not complaints about others. It's not a complaint about the weather, or the work, or the economy, or any of the outside issues. It is usually a complaint about oneself. This is a very inward looking journey for an inward liberation. And you all understand this, and I want you all to always keep this in mind. This is a very internal affair. The battle wages on. As the harpoons and the swords are pulled out of their sheaths and fired, and the arrows pulled back against the bows and swung forward, they make no noise. They make absolutely no noise. But the war wages on. The battle goes on. Day in, day out, the battle goes on. And I think you're all part of that army, and I want you all to keep fighting. When we get together like this once a week, I will share with you, we share with you battle tactics, the art of war, the science of war, the methods of war, how to wage war, how to battle your enemy, how to first identify your enemy, and so on. So this is battle school. Because you're in the army now. And in order to become successful in this, it is important both to have good, strong, sharp weapons as much as a strong shield. Your shield is to protect yourself, and your weapon is to attack. But you must understand that you are alone on the battleground. So one could ask the question, who do I protect myself from? If I'm a lone soldier, as I look around, I see no one. This land is barren and is soulless. I'm the only one standing. So why do I carry this shield with me? Why do I carry this sword with me? As I said, the shield is to protect yourself, to guard yourself. Your virtue must be your shield, folks. This is your sealer, your virtues. Your virtues will protect you. They will guard you. The stronger your virtue, the more virtuous you are, the more you shall be guarded when the enemies attack you. Double-edged sword. Fear not if you have a good shield, because until a companion, a compadre, comes up to you and offers you a weapon, you can remain protected, guarded, if you hold a strong shield. So this is why your virtues are very important. Continue to work on them. Your virtues will protect you, while your weapon will help you fight. You understand, any soldier does not go into the battleground without a weapon and without a shield. Even if they don't have a weapon, from the weapons of their enemies. How strong is your shield? How strong is your shield? Can it withstand the brutal force of your enemy's weapons? The blows are fatal if you don't watch out. They can pierce through weak armor. So do you have a shield that is strong enough? Do you have a shield which can withstand such force? you have a shield which can withstand the power of the enemy's weapon. So you need to work on it then. You need to work on it. As I say, even if your weapon is not that sharp, even if your weapon is not to the best of standards, it's not the best quality, that is still fine if you have a good shield, because a teacher, a companion can come to your rescue. And they may be able to either fight on your behalf or share with you a weapon that they have. But for them to do that, you must remain alive. And to remain alive, what you use is not your weapon. To remain alive, what you use is your shield. Your virtue is your shield. So guard your virtues as a soldier would guard his shield when out in the battlefield. What do I mean by these virtues? By virtues I mean refraining, abstaining from all the unmeritorious deeds. Don't take another's life because your life depends on it. You understand my words? Don't take another's life because your shield is how well you guard your virtues. A weak shield, a shield is only as strong as its weakest spot. The moment your soldier attacks on the weakest spot on the shield cracks up and it collapses, and then you are left unguarded. The next blow will probably be a fatal one. So you must guard your virtue, folks, like a soldier guards his shield on the battlefield. The first of these virtues is, as I have mentioned, abstaining from taking another's life. And that is true on many levels. It is not only the separating of life form from the physical body, but also another's personality. Be careful in your conduct with others, lest your words pierce their minds and tear them up. It is said that words are like a sharp sword, as it draws blood without leaving a mark. So be careful, be mindful. I can't think any of you may physically inflict any pain on another person. It's hard to think that people of your caliber, people mindful, let us continue to be careful until we know we have won this battle. Our weaknesses are our worst enemies. Desire, aversion, delusion, these are our enemies, and they will attack at every opportunity. You must guard yourself at every cost, at all costs. You must guard yourself. Don't let your shield down, no matter what you do. If any of you have done any martial arts, as I remember my instructor taught me once, you've got the two arms, he said, one to punch and one to guard yourself. Even if you don't punch, he said, make sure you have your guarding arm always up. That is what protects you. Your punching arm is what retaliates. This is what you use as your weapon. But you must always be up, always up. Never let that down. Because your enemy is looking for the moment when you let your guard down, more than enough. And you know there is no worse enemy than Raga, Dvesha and Moha. The terrible trio. Oh, they are the terrible trio. There is nothing worse than them. Because they have no mercy. Whether you are a Pratakjana, whether you are a subhuman species, or not even human yet, or whether you are a Sotapanna, Sakrudagami, even an Anagami, or perhaps you are a wheel-turning monarch, or an empire, or an emperor even. Perhaps you are the king of all the heavens. Maybe you are the god of all gods. Still, the terrible trio, they're always watching out. They're always watching for the moment you let your guard down. And they will attack. They will not show you any mercy. So you must always be vigilant. Always have your guard up. And that guard, I'm telling you folks, is your virtues. They are your virtues, your sila. It is very important. It is one who protects their sila through samadhi. They will be able to develop their prajna. Of course, this all starts with prajna. That is what kicks the whole thing off as you one day get to listen to a sermon and the light bulb goes on. You have that eureka moment. I realize what I'm about, what I need to do now. In fact, you realize that you are a lone soldier in this battlefield. Up until then, what people think is, I'm a soldier and there's all these people around me. That day you realize that actually all these other people on the battlefield, they're not here to fight me. They are just like me. They're not here to fight me. They are just like me. They're fighting the enemy which lives on the inside. So yes, we are all on the battlefield, but we are all alone. All together, and yet, all alone. Once we realize this. Until then, you'll see on the far side of the battlefield that there'll still be people fighting each other. Soldiers fighting each other. They'll be brandishing their swords as they run to their enemy, trying to whack them with it, slice them and dice them with their swords, and cut them up in half. They don't realize that with every attack they make, on the inside, the enemy strengthens. The enemy grows in strength. They don't realize that. One day you realize that, hey, hang on a second. All these people, they've all got a shield, they've all got a weapon, but who is the real enemy here? Just because the other guy is dressed differently doesn't mean he is my enemy. Just because the other guy is of a different complexion, why do I think that he's my enemy? Why do I feel that she's my enemy? Just because the other guy is richer than me, just because he's got more than me, why do I feel that he's my enemy? One day you realize actually they're all fighting their own battles. It's each man to himself. That's when you realize the battle is happening on the inside. But you can't drop your shield, and of course you need to work on your martial tactics, and you must make sure that you have a good weapon. So as I remind you again, your virtues are your shield. It belongs to you as your life depends on it. Stealing is for cowards. It's not for warriors. What warriors do, on the other hand, is they give away what they have. Cowards, they take from others what they don't have. If you want to strengthen your shield, folks, be someone who gives, not someone who takes. If you want to take something, the only thing I would say you're allowed to take, under my watch, if you consider us to be your teachers, then the only things we take, I will tell you, the only things we take is other people's pain. And in return, we give them happiness. We lend them an ear. We lend them a shoulder. We extend our arms for them to reach out and reach out to them and lift them out of the lurch, just as others do for us, just as our teachers do and have done for us. That is what you are allowed to give. Give compassion, give kindness, give generosity. Give. Take other people's pain. Take it away from them. Be a shock absorber. Absorb the shock that other people bring up onto you. Be able to tolerate and bear. Be someone who can take other people's tears away from them, others' pain away from them, others' weeps and laments away from them. Be someone who can extend a word of kindness. Be someone who can give mercy in the most difficult of times. That's all people are looking for. A bit of mercy. A ear that's prepared to listen to them. Be someone who can give that. That is what you need to give. And what you need to take, take other people's pain. Take other people's suffering. In other words, listen to them. Pay attention to what they have to say. Let them come up to you and cry. Don't say stop crying before you say anything else. Let them cry. Let them cry their eyes out. And once they have done so, you have absorbed the pain and the suffering that they have up until that point. Bore on their two shoulders with great difficulty. And then, once you've done that, now give. So there is a time when you must first take and then give. Now give. Now give the way to free oneself from that, so that it doesn't happen again, so that they don't have to suffer again. Give them the secret. Give them the medicine. Give them a weapon. Give them a shield. So that they can stand up for themselves. So that they can fight their own war. So that they don't have to come running up to you the next time they have a problem. So give. And while you do that, make sure you hold your shield high up. Because it matters not that you're helping someone else. Your enemies will attack you. They're just looking for the moment when you let your guard down. It may be that sometimes people come up to you, they bring their problems to you, and they share it with you looking for some solace, looking for some comforting words. And, of course, that is the intention with which you begin. To talk to them, to pacify them. But without your knowledge, unbeknown to you, do you not realize that as the conversation continues, you turn from a kind, compassionate soul to one who is the knowledgeable one, the one who knows, the one who is there to guard them, to protect them, that creeps into the mind, unbeknown to you. Any thoughts of indulgence in sensual pleasures? Every time you give in to that, folks, that's when your shield goes down. And then your enemies attack you. So don't let that happen. Now, as much as I say this, there will be times when it does happen. Reduce the frequency with which it happens. You know, when you work on this path, on these instructions, do it one step at a time. A journey of your desires is not a switch you can turn off just like that. Sensual desires is something that will diminish over time, provided you are doing the necessary. But guard yourself. Thoughts will come into your mind, but don't let them loose. Don't let them loose whereby they go forward, and they start to enact themselves through body and speech. Guard yourself in that way. So abstain from sensual desires and its gratification as much as you possibly can. Because giving in to those desires is not a good battle tactic. Every time you give in to it, every time your enemy grows stronger. Because that's one weakness on the shield. That's one soft spot on the shield. Your enemy now realizes that on these occasions, your shield goes down. That is what the enemy does. And you will have various things which do it for you. For some of you, it may be an item of food. For others, it may be a gadget of some sort. For others, it may be a person. For others, it may be money, smells, fragrances, perfumes. Perhaps it's your grandfather's clock. Watch out. Whenever the thought comes into your mind, and then you go on to rejoice in that, that's a moment where you let your guard down. And then your enemy infiltrates the camp. And they will fight until you have dropped dead. They will torture you. They'll tear you up. Have you honestly not experienced the pain of desire? I'm sure you'll all have experienced the pain of aversion. When aversion, strong anger and hatred comes to mind, you know, that really kills on the inside. I think you all have plenty of experience in that aspect. But what about desire? Sometimes desire is not necessarily seen in that way. But it is very much so. It's still very much so a killer on the inside. We do say that desire is a bond. And a bond is something that binds you. So when you are bound mentally, you are bound to something. And then that very thing has taken over control of your happiness. Haven't there been times when you wanted something really bad, and then every time it got delayed, how did you feel about it? Perhaps you're waiting for a call. Perhaps you're waiting for someone to arrive at the arrivals lounge. Perhaps you're waiting for the cake to have finished baking in the oven and for the alarm to go off. Perhaps you are waiting for your husband or your father, your mother, to return from work, as they have promised you that they are going to be bringing you something nice. Perhaps you are waiting for the postman, as you have ordered something online and you are waiting for the delivery. Think back to the waiting game. Any knock on the door, you stand up and you rush to the door. Your little legs can't carry you fast enough. Only when you open the door, you realize that he wasn't a person after all. He was just some leaf falling from a tree that got swept in the wind and just brushed on your door. Or perhaps it was just your pet cat trying to get the door opened. He wasn't the postman after all. He wasn't who you were waiting for after all. Because it's difficult sometimes to see desire as being a fire that kills on the inside. And then people let their guards down. And then they go ahead. You know, this is the problem with the enemy of desire. See, desire, aversion and delusion, they have their own strategies. Each of these enemies, they're unique in the way that they fight. In the way they attack us, they're very unique. The Buddha says, Natthi rago samanaggi. What he meant by that is, the fire of desire is unlike any other fire. Because it's like a forest fire. It doesn't stop until everything in its path has been consumed by it. This is unlike desire. This is unlike aversion. Aversion is different. Because with aversion, there's a limit to how far you can go. There's a limit to how much you can get angry, right? I'm not talking about grudges and holding on to them for many years or a period of time. I don't mean by that. I mean the anger that comes into the mind. There's a limit to how far it can go. And when it gets really bad, what happens is normally the person that's gotten angry faints because they can't take it anymore. I haven't heard of anyone who fainted because they couldn't bear the desire, the fire of desire. But the fire of anger, aversion, there's a limit to how far it can go. And then the person collapses. So they are given some time to recover. But not so when it comes to desire. It is limitless. The fire of desire is limitless. But I'm asking you, you've got to think about the times when you will have experienced it. And how did that make you feel? Think back to the times when the fire of desire started encroaching your mind. And then how unbeknown to you it started to spread. Little by little. The waiting game. Remember the waiting game? When you wait for something, when you wait for someone. Right? That vexation. It's difficult to even think of the Dhamma on those occasions. So it's a very funny animal, desire. It's very peculiar in that it's nothing like aversion. That's why the Buddha says, Natthi rago samanaggi. There is no fire like the fire of desire, because it burns unforgivingly, mercilessly. It'll keep on burning until anything that is flammable, anything in its way, has been consumed completely. So your desire, and besides, you know, do you think about this for a moment? Sometimes the things that you are angry with, right? You become angry with something or someone. Let's take someone for the sake of this conversation. You become angry with someone, and then perhaps you hold on to it, you harbor it for a little while, and then you're waiting for a moment to speak out your mind. When the moment arrives, you say your piece. Perhaps it burns a bridge or two. Still, you've said your piece and you feel relaxed, relieved. And then usually what happens is at the end of every fight, right, there's some making up that happens, right? Think about in your domestic life, in your families, whenever there's a fight, husband, wife, right, children, parents, whenever there's a fight, whenever there's an argument, whenever there's any misunderstanding and heated words get exchanged, after a while, right, people make up. Sometimes, you know, they make something nice, or cook something nice and go, you know, I'm really sorry about what I said earlier on. I've made your favorite dish. Here you go. Right? So these things happen. Maybe it's a soft toy to say I'm sorry. Or a card. Or perhaps a hug. Or a kiss. And then, you know, people make up. And that's the end of it. And sometimes people even say, you know, our relationship is all the more stronger for it. We've had the fight. We resolved our misunderstandings, our differences. We discussed it through. And now we are better than we ever were. Why people say that? But when it comes to desire, where do you draw the curtains? What is the grand finale? Is there? And think about something you have always desired. Right? Again, I'll take a person. Just to keep it simple. Right? When you desire a person, where do you draw the line? Do you ever draw the line? Yes, you want someone else also after a while. And I don't mean about, you know, becoming frivolous with your relationships. What I mean is, you know, even if you are attached to one person, say a very, a brotherly relationship with someone. Right? So your brother. Oh, I'll take a friend. Right? You have a friend. And after a while, it may be that another person becomes your friend. But what you'd rather is have more friends added on to your friend list rather than people being taken out of it. So the original friend, the friend number one, still continues to be your friend. If it comes to something like a food item, maybe something you can relate to even better. Right? Over the course of time, of course you have acquired various tastes and various desires for tastes and food items and so on. Right? But the things that you used to like from your childhood times, say you liked rambutan, that was maybe your favorite fruit as a young child. It may be that today your favorite fruit is lychees or avocados, but you still like rambutan. So that desire, there was not an end to it. Just things kept getting added on to it. It just keeps piling on. That's why I say desire is a very different animal to aversion. It's very difficult to beat. And the worst thing is, it's very difficult to identify. Because when you're feeling desirous of something, you don't necessarily feel that there's a problem. It's very easy to spot the problem being on the outside. I want it and it's not mine yet. So that's the problem. When you're desiring of something, it's very difficult to identify that the problem is within. because you feel very positive about it. And every way you look, people talk about desiring, and people talk about wanting things, and people talk about acquiring things, and you know, acquisitions and conquering and greed and collecting and gathering. Right? So people talk about, because this is what is required for one's protection, one's sustenance. You need to have things around you. Right from when we were gatherer hunters. Way back. They didn't stop at hunting, they gathered. Because whatever they had around them was there to protect them. These were the things that were there to safeguard them for their sustenance. So in the same vein, the things that you have today, the things that you have collected and surrounded yourself with today, folks, really they say a lot about you. And it's got you written all over them. It says a lot about you. Right from the way you dress, your ornaments, the things you have on your fireplace, the things you have on your teepee, the things you have in your fridge, in your cupboards, in your drawers, in your wardrobes, they do say a lot about you, don't they? They talk about how you remain happy. So really they talk about you. You and your happiness. So these are desires. These are the things, you know, every item that you have collected, if you just look around, what does that say about your desire? Does that not have something to say about your desires and how you desire them? The nature of your desire? All the collectibles that you have, all the things you have in your lockers, in your wardrobes, in your drawers. Phone numbers. Who do you have on your contacts list? Does that not say a lot about you and who you are? Does that not say a lot about your desires? You know, I think from time to time, it's interesting. What I would suggest is from time to time, go through that list. You know, take your phone and go through your contacts list. You know, just do it once in a while. And see what that says about you. You don't need to ring anyone. You don't need to call anyone. Just go through your contacts list. And see what that says about you. About you and the kind of person you are, the things that you like, the things you fancy. These are ways you can study yourself. I'm talking about your shield, and the reference to this is clearly in the pursuit of the things that you desire. You may drop your shield. And really, it is because you dropped your shield, the enemy attacked you in the first place. And what it does is it intoxifies you. And you lose all sense of your being, and including your well-being. You lose all sense of who you are, what you're here for, that you're a soldier on the battleground. Right? And you go into a world of hallucinations. So you can imagine, so think of it as a hallucinatory drug. So now there is no reason for you to lift your shield. Because you have lost the plot. You have forgotten. You have completely lost consciousness of the fact that you are in the battleground and you have just been attacked. That is why you got to watch out. That is why you need a strong shield. And if you think, just look around your home, on your phone, on your computer, right? If you have a DVD player, look at the DVD sets that you have on the side, right? The kind of things that you like to please your eyes with. You walk into the kitchen and you'll be able to see the kind of things you like to please your tongue with. You walk into the bedroom, you'll be able to see the kind of things you like to please your nose with. Right? You go walk into the living room, you'll be able to see the kind of things you like to please your ears with, your eyes with. See? And when you start looking at them from this angle, you'll see all those places where you dropped your shield. Those are your weaknesses, your tender spots. Can you spot your weaknesses? What I'm asking you to do is not now give everything away. You know, do a boot sale and give everything away. That's not what I'm asking you to do. What I'm asking you to do is to realize how they got there in the first place. Remember in one of our meditation sessions, one of the things I asked, we talked about is, I asked you to take me home with you. Take the Swami Nuanse home with you. Visualize that you've taken me home with you and you've got me stood outside and you're now about to invite me in. You know the way I think about things. The way I think about you, the way I think about the way people live and how that speaks volumes about them and their nature. Right? And now you have to invite me in. And as I walk in, I look around your living room and I ask you, what's this about? I'm pointing at a fish tank and I'm asking you, what's this about? And you're going to have to explain now. And then there's a flower vase. And now you're going to have to explain. And then there's your sofa with the matching upholstery that goes with the curtains. And now you have to explain why it is that they have to match. And why it is that you have a certain... Why is it that they have to be of a certain color, a certain texture. Things you have to explain. And then as I walk in, I smell something and I ask you, do I smell flowers? Is that jasmine or is that sandalwood? Or is that potpourri? Explain that to me, please. And you're going to have to come up with some explanations. You know, see yourself by looking at the world around you. Look at the world around you to see yourself, not to see others. Look at the times when you dropped your guard, your shield. Open your fridge and your freezer, and look at the times when you dropped your shield. It's now too late to throw it out. That's not what we need to do. We just need to realize that was a weak spot, that was a weak spot, that was a weak spot, that was a weak spot. You know, you can do your own SWOT analysis. What were my weaknesses? What were the threats? And when threat meets weakness, now you have a catastrophe. That's the making of a catastrophe, isn't it? The making of a disaster. When a threat meets a weakness, a threat comes from the outside, a weakness on the inside. When these two meet, you have a disaster. So look around you, look at the things you have at home. Walk up to your bedroom. Look in your closet. Look on the bed, look under the bed. Look in the drawers. Look in the master bedroom. Look in your jewelry box. Look in the cupboards in the kitchen. Look in the cupboards in the bedrooms. You know what I said, bedrooms. Walk out into the garden and look out. Give it a good scan. Look at the daffodils and the barbendaceas, the roses and the tulips. Do you see moments when you drop your shield and you let the terrible trio infiltrate your camp? That's not what I mean, but you do understand that mithyaditti or wrong understanding is one of the 10 unwholesome deeds. Covetousness is an unwholesome deed of the mind. This is a mental unwholesome deed. It causes others no harm, no hurt, no damage. But it's something to think about. You know, so please do understand that when we talk about the unmeritorious deeds, it can be construed in two ways. One is in terms of the pain, the hurt, the damage you impact on you. And then the other angle is what you do to yourself. What you do to yourself in terms of the damage you inflict on yourself. So, if you want to do this in a very practical way, it's important to study yourself. After all, Buddhism is a study of oneself. The science that was preached by the Buddha is applied into one's life. Stand in front of the mirror and look at the way you've dressed yourself. Look at the way you groomed yourself. Do you wear a mustache or a beard? Or is it a goatee? Why so? Do you wear earrings or bangles? Again, do I say to remove them, throw them away? No, absolutely not. Please don't do that. That is not what I'm asking you to do. The question remains, why? What was the intention? Was it simply to fit into the norm? You know, if you had completely shaved your head, then people are going to think you've gone mad. Is it purely to avoid that you colored your hair? Is it purely to avoid that you today wear a ring on your finger and one on your nose? Bangles and earrings and a necklace? Is it simply for that? Or really, do you also take satisfaction from that? When you stand in front of the mirror, do you take satisfaction from what you see? What you see in the mirror? Does that make you happy? What you see in the mirror, does that make you happy? Is that why you have dressed it that way? It's almost as if, you know, in this fashion stores or clothes shops, they have these mannequins, don't they? And then they dress these mannequins up from time to time to put on display what they have in store, the seasonal, you know, whatever is hot in the season. What's hot this season? So it's a display. And so they dress these mannequins up in very, very carefully so that they flaunt their best assets. so that they flaunt the best attributes of that particular item of clothing. So essentially, you look at the mannequin and then you think to yourself, this is probably what I'm going to look like in this. Does it ever? Is it ever what you look like? I'll reserve myself from answering that question, but you know the answer. You look at the mannequin and you think, if it looks nice on that, well, surely got to look nice on this. So you walk into the store, you pick one up, you put it on, and then you walk out thinking you look exactly like that, the figure in the mannequin. Try asking someone else. But anyway, that's besides the point. My question is, when you walk up to the mirror and stand in front of it, are you not really dressing up a mannequin like the storekeeper dresses up the mannequin? Are you not dressing up this body in the same way they do? So they dress it up and make sure that, you know, where the thing has to be tucked, it's tucked. Where the thing has to be let loose, you know, to flow, that is the way they put it. The way it's got to be tied back, they tie it back. Where it's got to be tied up, they tie it up. Where it's got to be pinned down, they pin it down. Right, so they do spend a little bit of time. And do you not do the same thing when you walk in front of the mirror? You know, dress up that mannequin? And some mannequins, they'll even do some touch-ups and some makeup and some, they'll add on the accessories. Shoes, socks, belt, tie, tie pin, hat. Right? The full works. And then the makeup. All of that goes on the mannequin. Do you not do the same? Why do they do that to the mannequin? It is to attract, right? It's to make it look attractive so that customers walk into the store. Do you mind if I ask you why you stand in front of the mirror and dress yourself up and groom yourself up and put on that makeup? Are you looking for, you'll excuse me for using this word, customers? Are you looking for customers? Where's that shield? What shield? Sometimes it feels that way, doesn't it? I'm saying, you know, these are things we all go through in our lives, folks. But it's not okay for me to say it's okay, is it? It happens in all our lives, and it used to happen in some of our lives, but that's not enough for us to say it's normal. Because is it? Is it normal? Do you listen to the stories of the great elders as they are related by Dasahandru? Do you not hear in those stories how both men and women, having taken on board the Dhamma, it transformed them, and they turned into very different people. People who used to spend time in front of the mirror do it no more. People who spend a lot of time grooming their bodies realize that this is just a waste of time. If there's anything I have to groom, it's my mind. And they start grooming their minds. If there's anything I need to be making up, it's not my eyelashes. It's my wisdom eye. That is how they are different. And that is how they went on to complete their journey. But I'm saying, you know, this is not something you've got to do just because I've asked you to, just because I haven't asked you to. I'm not asking you to drop anything. I'm just asking you to think about these things, right? You don't need anyone's permission to think about something, do you? And there's nothing to be lost in thinking, right? There's no expense there. So all I'm asking you to do is think. Think about these things. Think about them for, you know, in just a little, slightly different way to how you always used to think. Just think about the same things in a little bit of a different way. You're not scared to think, are you? I know, because some people are like that. Right? Some people are really scared. They're really afraid of listening to the Dhamma. I know people like that. I know couples who are very scared. They're very afraid of the Dhamma. So, sometimes the wife does not permit the husband to listen to the Dhamma. Sometimes the Dhamma does not, the husband does not permit the wife to listen to the Dhamma. You know, from my perspective, I have a lot of respect for people like that. You may ask, how come, Swaminathan? So what's that all about? Well, let me explain to you. I'll take an example. Let's say your husband does not wish for you to listen to the Dhamma. He does not like you to come to the sermons, listen to the Dhamma sermons. He says, rubbish, don't let me catch you listening to any of this stuff. And sometimes if you ask why, if you dig deep enough, you realize that he's worried. What's he worried about? He's worried that if you listen to the Dhamma, these sermons, that you might gradually get fed up of a household life and you might gradually lose your sensual desires. You might gradually lose interest in a lay life. In fact, he may be worried that over time, if you listen to the sermons, you will begin to have more compassion towards him than passion. By passion, I mean, you know, love and the more sensual type of attachments. But that gets replaced with compassion. So I feel that they're worried about that. Now, so why do I have respect for them? Well, I have respect for them because they are strong believers that the Dhamma can do that. They believe in the Dhamma. Now, it may be that they don't listen to the Dhamma, but still they believe in the Dhamma, don't they? They believe in the power of the Dhamma. Compare that to someone who says, you go listen to any Dhamma you want. I know it's not going to make any difference to you. That man does not believe in the Dhamma. He does not realize that the Dhamma can completely change someone. 100%. Completely different person. At the end of one sermon. This man does not believe that. That's why he might say, you go listen to any Dhamma sermon you want. It's not like that's going to change you any bit. But someone who's worried, someone who's fearful, someone who does not like to send you to a Dhamma sermon or does not like to have you listen to sermons at home, some of you may be in similar situations. I say, in my opinion, I have a lot of respect for people like that. Both men and women who forbid either their spouses or their children, their friends or, you know, their siblings from listening to the Dhamma because they say, no, this is going to completely corrupt you. It's going to completely make you get fed up of life. I don't want that to happen to you. Essentially what they're saying is, I think the Dhamma works. I think the Dhamma works. I think the Dhamma is going to get you to realize that this life is meaningless. I just don't want that to happen to you. I mean, does that not say a lot about the strength of their bonds? I just think about it. I know I've taken a bit of a diversion here, but as it came up, I'll just say this and conclude this matter. You know, when there's a new couple, you know, just married, right? And if you ask them, they are devoted to each other. Like they can't, you know, they won't be able to, they wouldn't be able to live a day without the other person's presence. That is how much love, affection, and devotion. They dote on each other, okay? So, then you offer them the Dhamma. You offer them the Dhamma. Say a sermon. I'm going to give you a sermon. Right? If you ask the boy, he's going to say, my wife, she loves me no matter what. I know that. I know she loves me. Wholeheartedly, there's nothing that can break that relationship. Okay, let's say that is the situation. That is how the guy believes. That is what the guy believes in. And then you say, tell the guy, right, okay, fine then. So you've got nothing to lose because it's not like she's going to change no matter what. Right? As you say, she loves you. She loves every cell in your body. So it's not like she's going to change. And so what's there to be lost in me doing a sermon to her? Let's get her to listen to a sermon. Oh, no. Oh, why? What's the problem? I'm scared. They might tell you how strong that love relationship, that bond was in the first place to begin with. It was so strong, right? They've been going out with each other for 15 years. Their relationship is so strong that one sermon can completely reverse that bond. That's a strong bond, isn't it? End of sarcasm. Okay, so back to where we were. Shield. Make sure you have a strong shield and you hold it, you have it held up all the time. Your shield is your virtue. So guard your virtues as you guard your life. Moving on then, you have speech. Words that can hurt others. Words of theft, words that can steal. Steal what? Words can steal another person's happiness. I mean, it's far easier to take another person's happiness with a word, isn't it? Than it is to actually take someone's happiness physically. It's much easier to hurt someone's feelings verbally than it is to hurt someone physically, is it not? You could do that from being miles away. That, you know, pick up the phone and ring up someone and say, I hate you. Because you're ugly. Right? That hurts them. Perhaps they're on the other side of the planet. So it's far easier to hurt someone with words than it is to hurt someone physically. But the moment you do that, folks, you have dropped your shield. And in fact, it is the dropping of your shield that allowed the enemy. That allowed the enemy to creep in. And then once it's in, the first thing it does is it intoxicates you. And that intoxication is very strong. With that intoxication, you go into hallucination mode. So now you live in a world of hallucinations. It's a make-believe world. In that world, the enemy is on the outside. Think about this, right? If you looked in a mirror, right, so you know this is a mirror, you're looking in a mirror, and you see someone other than yourself, what's going on? You look in a mirror, and you see someone other than yourself, what's going on? So either what you thought was a mirror is not a mirror after all. It's actually just a piece of glass. You know, some people do it for pranks. I'm sure you'll have seen things like that on, you know, various videos on YouTube and things like that. Okay, but so either this is not a mirror and it's just a sheet of glass, or if it's actually, if it's really a mirror, if it is indeed a mirror, then you are seeing a hallucination. Yes or no? What you are seeing is a hallucination. Okay, now apply the same concept to what we have been talking about. When there's a problem and you try to look in the mirror, you look in the mirror to see where's the problem. If you see anyone but yourself, either what you're looking at is not a mirror, or what you're seeing is a hallucination. To keep it really simple, you could say, well, you're not looking in the mirror. You're just looking out the glass. That's why I said, I think we talked about this long time ago. When you have a problem and you want to find the culprit, look through the glass. If you see someone else, you're not looking at the mirror. If you see yourself, now you're looking in the mirror. Anytime you see a problem and you see someone else, it would not be right for you to say that I am virtuous and I always look at myself when there's a problem. That would not be right. Because that's incorrect. If you see anyone but yourself, you're not looking in the mirror. And when you have a problem, the only place you need to be looking at is the mirror. I'm talking about problems of the mind. Right? When there's a problem that affects you physically, then yes, there may be a valid reason for you to be looking outside and perhaps finding solutions there. But I'm talking about when you're looking for a reason as to why you are mentally hurt. Don't look out there. Look inside. Look internally. Look in the mirror. Always look in the mirror. Now, yesterday's sermon. So we have now started doing a Sinhala sermon, which is a recording, unlike this one. I mentioned something which I thought was pretty useful. So this was a practical way of practicing the Dhamma, practicing the path. And I'll share it with you folks as well, because I'm trying to focus this on the practical aspect of how you wage war. You know, if you have signed up, if you have enlisted yourself into the army, you're in the army now, right? And you have been handed a shield and a weapon. This is how you fight. You have now enlisted yourself willingly. You have proclaimed that you are a disciple of the Buddha, Bhagavato Tassa Savako Hamasmi. Right, so essentially, that's putting your sword up in the air and saying, I'm ready to fight. I'm here for the war. Bring it on. That's what you're saying. So when you make that invitation, boy oh boy, are they going to bring it on or what? They will bring it on. So, what are some of the practical things you can do? So one of the practical things I said you could do was, as I said, you know, walk around the house from time to time. As in, not on the outside. You could do that also. But, you know, have a walk around indoors and study the things that you have accumulated throughout your life. Particularly in the recent times. Because that will probably be more representative of your current state of mind. Maybe not what you got 10 years ago. That perhaps, you know, you've changed, you've grown over it. But maybe something that you got yourself within the last year, within the last 6 months, last 3 months. Something which takes a center point at home. Right? You know, sometimes, you know, like there are certain things at home, they're not hidden away. You place them very strategically. They have a place in your home. Right? The flowers has a place in your home. There's a place for it. Usually if there's a place for something, then it's something that's important to you. Otherwise they just get shoved in a box and put into the garage or some kind of, you know, storeroom or something like that. Usually if it has a distinguished place, then it does actually have a distinguished place in your heart, in your mind. Right, so walk around the home, you know, on one day you could do one room in your home, in your house, and make a list of some of the things which just make a list of some of the things. And then when you return, and you know, you've gone on your tour and you've returned now, have a sit down and, you know, just go through that list and think about some of these things you have accumulated. Think about some of the things you have on that list and ask yourself, what does this say about me? What does this say about me? This wristwatch, what does it say about me? Because it may be perhaps when you got it, you just got carried away. And it was, everything had just happened too fast for you to contemplate on anything. But now is a good time to contemplate. Because I know one of the areas where people might struggle is, you know, you learn the Dhamma, you understand the Dhamma, but now where do you apply the Dhamma? That I feel that sometimes people struggle there. I want to apply the Dhamma also. I'm prepared for it, but I just don't know what to apply the Dhamma to. Swami Nasa says, apply the Dhamma, make this practical. But what do I apply the Dhamma to? And then the Swami Nasa says, life. Yeah, life is the lab. Yeah, so what do you mean by life? Some people have this problem. You know, the real results are to be gained, folks, when you do the application, which I have said countless times before, as I have done now. So how do you find the practical, how do you find the opportunities to practice? So again, we talked about the SWOT analysis. You know your weakness and you know the threat. Now I'm talking about, if you have identified a strength, which is your understanding of the Dhamma, then go find a list of opportunities. Get those opportunities on a sheet of paper, sit down and then go through that list and ask yourself, what does this say about me? What was my state of mind, the frame of mind I had in a time in my life when I decided I wanted to get myself this item? Walk up to the fridge, for those of you who prefer to do that, and make a list of the things you have in there. Right, walk back up to your sofa, sit down and then go through that list and ask yourself, these things that I have in my fridge, these things I have in my fridge freezer, what does that say about me? That's for Lokabuddha. That's for Podiputta. That's for Lokapusa. This is for Podipusa. Don't just go through the list like sort of, you know, saying that's not for me, this is not for me, none of this is for me after all, right? So really you don't have anything in the fridge then. Unlikely, I think. Okay, so get that list, sit down and go through it. And ask yourself, what does it say about me? I don't want you to make any decisions out of it as to what you're going to do to that item henceforth. That is not what I'm asking you to do. That is not part of this activity. It may be that you decide to do whatever you want with it, but that's not within the scope of what I'm asking you to do here. All I want as an outcome from this activity is for you to have gone through the list of the things that you hold near and dear to you. Just go through that list and ask yourself, what does that say about me? What was the state of mind I was in when I acquired that item? Eventually, you can actually do the same with the people who live at home with you. Make a list of the people who live at home with you and then go through that list and ask yourself, what does that say about me? What does this say about me? Was this a time when I dropped my guard, my shield? Right? So that's one of the things you can do. A list of the things that you already own and possess. Don't forget your car. Yes, that was an intentional S at the end of that. Don't forget your cars. Okay, make a list of the things. You can even go as far as your curtains and the fact that you've got tiled floors and the patterns on those tiled floors, and maybe perhaps your waterfall that you have at home. What else do you have at home? Do you have a pet lion at home? You can include that in the list also. Right? All those things. Oh, and if you have a season card, for what? What not? I think you can have a season card for these eateries, right? The places you go, restaurants. Season card, don't they have that? Like a frequent customer card? Like those air miles cards, don't they have pizza kilos cards? You know, air miles, pizza, kilos, right? So don't they do those cards now? I don't know. I think they used to. What does that say about you? Don't leave any stone unturned. Take out your wallet, your purse, for those who carry one of those, your handbag. Have a good look inside. If it's particularly a handbag, right, once you've got all the spiders out, then you'll be able to see some of the things which went in there long time ago. You know, donkeys, yes. You'll see some of the things that went into that bag long time ago. And that may say a lot about you back then. Ask yourself, is it true? You know, what this says about me, or what this said about me back then, is it still true? Is it still true? What does it say about me? These are some practical things you can do. If you really want to do this, you have to do this the way I have asked you to. At least the way I have suggested you do. Which is, take a sheet of paper, walk around your home, walk around the house. If you've got 7 bedrooms, maybe you can't cover it within the day. And do 1 bedroom a day. Right? Whenever you get the chance. Now, for instance, next week, as I reminded you, let me just check, it is next week indeed. Yes, it is next week. So next week, the 29th Sunday, we don't have a sermon, as I mentioned last week. But it would normally be our meditation week, wouldn't it? So, what would you do, given that next week is normally meditation week, and unfortunately we don't have the meditation sermon? So what do you do then? Throw a party, what else? No, of course you don't. What we do is we try and find some time between now and next week to do some meditation. Now, you don't need the Swami Nuhansay to be guiding you. I've done plenty of guiding. This is the guidance. So you could consider this the instruction, the guidance for the next week's sermon, which we won't be able to do. So you can still do it at home. Get a sheet of paper. Write down a list of the things you have at home, both living and non-living. By the way, if you only got 2 hours to do this, as in the whole thing, don't spend 1.5 hours making a list. Right? Quarter of an hour, at most half an hour. Make a list of the things you want, and then the remaining 3/4 of the time you have should be spent on the actual contemplation. What does this say about me? Is that a moment when I drop my shield? Was it desire, aversion, or delusion that attacked me? There may be some things on there which you can quite honestly, right, honest to your heart, you can say, actually, this I had to get for myself because, you know, I wouldn't be able to be alive without this. Or it's something that I have to use given the the setting that I'm in, given the street that we live in. Everyone has one of these, and if I don't get one of these, then I'm just going to look like a sore thumb. So I had to get one of these. All of those things, fine. You can discount them. I just put a line across them. That's fine. You can discount all of them. The others, the remaining things, you can ask yourself, what does it say about me? Right, so that's one of the things you could do. For those of you who might not be too keen on that, let me suggest something else. Perhaps what you can do is today, right? Now, you're going to have to allow a week for this. So you can do your meditation next week. From today on, if you are used to clearing your browsing history or your YouTube watch history, right? Switch it back on. And then by the end of next week, when you're actually going to go and just sit down for your meditation, just get a list, a printout or a copy of your browsing habits for that week. Now, I know this is not going to be a perfect science because you know you're going to be marking your homework at the end of the week, so it may be you'll be careful. But I think you can trick the sheet of paper, but you can't fool yourself. That's one person you can't fool, your self-conscience. Right? As much as you possibly can, go through a normal, your regular online habit, right? And then get a list of that. And now go through that list. Once you get your printout, you can delete your history. What are some of the sites you've been on? And what do those sites say about you? Did I drop my shield? Because it's only a week, you'll be able to remember those instances. Did I drop my shield? What does it say about me? Right, so that's one thing you can do. And again, I'll give you another suggestion. For those who might not be so keen on that, perhaps one of the things you can do is make a list of the things you eat through the course of the week. And by eating, I mean anything that goes through your mouth. Anything. Anything that goes through your mouth, anything edible that goes through your mouth. Okay, not the rubber band you swallow by mistake. Although that could go on the list, and again you could ask yourself, what does that say about me? But even if you don't go that far, you can still, the things that go into your mouth, you can make a list of that, and at the end of the week ask yourself, what does that say about me? The foods that you eat, what does that say about me? So, don't try to fool yourself by not including the snacks that you take or the odd soft drink, the odd, within air quotes, the odd soft drink. So don't forget the odd soft drink, because we want all those oddities in the list also. Right? Chocolates. Right? So that needs to be on that list. As much as all the other good stuff, right? They also all need to be on that list. So that's another way you can do it. And then at the end of the week, when you sit down for meditation, ask yourself, what does this say about me? Did I drop my shield? Was this an instance when I dropped my shield? When I allowed the terrible trio to infiltrate my camp? Do you still have that anger jar? I don't know, is that what we called it? The anger jar? Can't remember now. I think we called it the anger jar. I asked you to have a jar at home and into it to drop a penny or a coin whenever you get angry. Your piggy bank, right? To drop a coin into it. And for the kids at home who still have no use of money, for them to drop an IOU note. What's an IOU note? It's a promise. So, for instance, it will be, I'll sweep the house, I'll wash the dishes, I'll mow the lawn, I'll wash the dog. Or, you know, you could go further and go, I'll listen to 10 minutes of the Dhamma sermon, I'll listen to half an hour, I'll do 20 minutes meditation, right? So, usually something that you feel is an expense. If you're really addicted to the Dhamma and you really enjoy the Dhamma, then you can't count the other bits. But things like, you know, chores at home, which you might not fancy doing that much. So children can do this with your parents, right? So the parents agree that these are the things that go on that list. You can't have, you know, I'm going to run away. Don't have that in there. So that's why I say get agreement from your parents as to what goes on that list. And then, or, you know, even things like I'm going to shave my head, because, again, that might cause problems. We don't want the problems. You're trying to solve problems. So get those on that list and have those chits ready with you. And then when you get angry, you have to come to an agreement that when you get angry, then normally it works best if you inform someone else. You can do this in pairs. You can do this with, you have an agreement with someone else at home, and both they and you have agreed to do this. So what they do is they, whenever you drop your shield, this is an instance of you having dropped the shield. So you can, you know, you can come to an agreement with your mother, for instance. Amma, whenever you drop your shield, you're going to have to put a coin in there. Okay? And Puta, yes, okay, I'll do that. I'll do that. But whenever you get angry, you have to drop an IOU note into it. So what do? At the end of the week, now what we did this initially was, once you've got this, once the jar fills up, you can take it out, count the coins, and actually give an alms to the Mahasangha or any any religious establishment of your choice, or perhaps an elder's home, or anywhere you fancy. But the intention was essentially, at the end of the collection, you're going to have to sit down with a monk or a nun. And at the end of the almsgiving, to get some advice by asking the question, Venerable Sir, part of this almsgiving was funded by our anger jar, right? And this is it, and money that we have been collecting in that has gone into this almsgiving. So, in exchange for the alms, Venerable Sir, would you mind please giving us a sermon on the on anger? On how do we work with anger? What do we do about it? And I know for a fact that there are some among you who actually did that, and who have been doing that. And I hope you have continued to do that. If you know all these good habits, folks, don't stop them. I told you last week. I feel you because you do them. Right. So don't stop any of them. Continue good habits. Good habits are difficult to start. It's more difficult to continue them, but they're very easy to stop. Okay, so once you've started a good habit, continue with it. What if it stops halfway through? Then restart and continue with it. And if it happens again, restart and continue with it. For as long as you believe that it's a good habit to have, get back on your feet and continue with it. So that's very important. So anyway, for the purpose of what we are asking you to do for next week, meditation, is if you've still got that anger jar, like get out your IOU notes from your children can do that. You can get a tally of the total you have collected, and actually the amount you have collected over the course of a week, what does that say about you? What does that say about you? I'm giving you ideas, right? These are things you can do. Okay, would you like another one? Okay, here you go. Another one you can do is take out your phone and find out your text messages. Or not find out your text messages, but rather get your text messages. Or if you are more a WhatsApper or a Facebooker, then you can get those messages you have sent other people, right? And the messages sent to other people, SMSs or other online messages, see if you can get a list of those messages. Maybe you won't be able to do all of it, but some proportion of it. Take that and then sit down and then ask yourself, looking at each of those messages, what does it say about me? Did I drop my shield? Is this is this does this represent a moment in time back on last Tuesday when I dropped my shield? That's a question you can ask yourself. So this is all very practical stuff. One might think, hang on, Swami, this is child play. What's all this got to do with Dhamma? Let me put it this way. I don't know what it's got to do with the Dhamma, but I know what it's doing to me. The things I tell you are things I have tried myself. And I know what it has done to me. So what it has got to do with the Dhamma? How about you answer your own question? What it has done for me is what it's done for me. I have changed. And I'm changing. These are all practical things. But sometimes people just don't like the practical stuff. Some people are quite reluctant to do the practical stuff. They're all very theoretically, you know, I just want to know the Dhamma. I just want to know the Dhamma points. Like the practical stuff, not so keen. Folks, seriously, get this down. Right? Results are for the doers. It's not for the knowers. If you want results, you gotta do. You gotta do it. And it's usually difficult to come up with the practical stuff. This is why I'm sharing some of these things with you. You know, just think about it. Right? These ideas that I share with you, sometimes you at the end of the sermon you go, Swami, no answer that. That thought never came to mind. But you still come and talk to me about some of the Dhamma points that came to your mind. That's the theory stuff. The practical application, situations, the examples, you know, that's some of the stuff that's sort of, you know, it takes a little while to cobble something up together. So that's why I'm sharing these things with you. Make it practical, folks. The Dhamma has to be practical. Nibbana is an extremely practical thing. There's nothing more practical than Nibbana. That's why it practically changes someone from a Pratajñana to an Arahant. It's a very practical thing. It's not theoretical. So identify those moments where you've dropped your shield. Where you were weak in your virtues. Where a slip of the tongue happened almost without thinking. You know, you'll learn a lot about yourself. That is what this period of quarantine is for. This period of self-isolation is for that. It's to isolate the self. Right? Identify these things, and then we can talk about the science behind it. You know, that's what I'm saying. I like you all to come to these sermons with something to work on. I hope you understand what I'm trying to say here. I like you all to come to these sermons with something to work on. As in, you have a problem to which you're looking for an answer. A very specific problem. Not a general problem of, you know, Swami, no answer. I'm being reborn. Can you help me? That's a very general question. And anyway, that's the grand 60,000 foot view problem. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about very specific problems. Very specific problems you will be able to identify if you actually do some of the practical stuff that I'm asking you to do here. Studying yourself. You got to study yourself to identify your practical problems, just like a doctor would do a diagnosis. Right? When you go into hospital, then one of the first things they do is they'll run some scans and they'll do some checkups. Various devices they'll hold to your body and Some will look on the screen, some will look at the device itself, some will wait for a beep. Right? These are all scanners to identify a specific problem. And that's when the treatment... So, going with that, they come up with a diagnosis. And then armed with that, we go into treatment. So, I'd like you all to consider the Dhamma as being treatment for very specific problems. Because when you approach it that way, folks, over time it will eventually treat the mega problem. It will eventually treat the big problem. But what you need to be doing on is working on specific problems. Let the compound effect take over. When you work on the specific problems, that'll complete the bigger picture. You know, just like working on a puzzle. How do you work on a puzzle? Right? Do you fit the whole puzzle in one go? Like if it's got 100 pieces, do you only got the two hands? How can you even fit 3 pieces together? You've only got 2 hands. So if it's got 100 pieces, you know for a fact that you've only got 1 piece that you're laying on the ground or wherever you're doing your puzzle, you're only laying 1 piece down at any given time. At most, you will have another piece in your other hand. So you suspect that this might be the other piece which has to fit with this piece. But that's the most. And then it's after you've laid down that piece, you start to think about, well, where's the next piece? Now you see here, you have a very specific problem, right? This piece in my hand, where does it go? That's a very specific problem. But what about the grand problem, which is, how do I complete the puzzle? Well, isn't what you're doing right now the steps you need to take in order to complete the grand problem? So really, at the end of the day, you never completed the puzzle, did you? What do you mean you never completed the puzzle? Well, you didn't complete the puzzle. That was not the action you took. The action you took was you put each piece in its rightful place. The puzzle completed itself. Those pieces coming together, that was the compound effect taking over. And also, as more pieces fit into to its rightful places, does it not become easier to complete the puzzle? The moment you lay down one piece, folks, now you only have 99 other places to fit. In fact, if you put 2 pieces together, right, now you only have another 98 pieces to worry about. So there's only 1 in a 98 chance. Whereas the previous piece was 1 in a 99 chance of getting it right. The third piece is 1 in a 98 chance of getting right. In fact, the third piece would be 1 in a 97 chance of getting right. And then the last piece, well, of course, it's 1 in a 100 chance. Oh, that was the first piece, 1 in a 100 chance. And in the last piece, you can't get it wrong, because there's only one place it's going to fit. Now, did you work on the... Did you actually bring the puzzle? Did you make the puzzle? Or all you did was each piece by piece, you put it in its rightful place? You'll all agree you did the latter. Likewise, what I'm saying is, when it comes to Nibbana, don't go grand. Okay, I think this is one of the best pieces of advice I can give you. When it comes to Nibbana, as much as it sounds so grand, and because, you know, when you talk about Nibbana, you're talking about the Supreme Buddha. Right? That's like as grand as it can be. And then you talk about the Arahants, the great Arahants. Right? And you talk about infinite compassion. Right? And infinite gracefulness. And infinite mercifulness. Right? You're talking about all these big things, big numbers. Right? And infinite length of time in samsara. incalculable eons. Everything's in. Right? And then you lose the plot. And the moment you talk about Nibbana, you think, good Lord, this is all infinite and incalculable and unimaginable. How on earth am I going to do it? That's because you're looking at the grand picture. You know, that's talking about the result. The Buddha is a result. The Buddha is a result. The Buddha is not the causes, it's the result. Buddhahood is a result. Arahathood is a result. Work on the causes. And the causes are one piece at a time. Each piece complements the next piece. That's why they say, the Dhamma complements the Dhamma on your path to Nibbana. The Dhamma is very complementary. It complements one piece of Dhamma, complements the next. And then they fulfill one after the other. So all you need to do is work on very specific things. You don't need to think grand. That's why when you want to attain Nibbana, the first thing you need to be doing is, in my opinion, not taking the Tripitaka out and, you know, the 52 books, go and get it out from a library, right? Or actually buy the 52 books of the Tripitaka, of the 54 books of the Tripitaka, and bring it and, you know, lay it in the shelf in your home library, and then think to yourself, right, where am I going to start? Man, that's going grand. That's going mega. I'm telling you, the mega is all, leave that to nature. Leave that to time. Leave that to vipakas. Yeah, I remember listening to a sermon one day. I think this was by a Catholic father. He said, you know, work on the seed, work on the fertilizer, work on the water, and work on getting some sunlight. So he's talking about a farmer who wants to grow a plant, right? He says, work on the seed. So plant the seed. Add some fertilizer, add some water, and make sure there's enough sunlight, right? And God will worry about the miracle of turning your seed into a tree. Now that's a wonderful way of expressing the same thing, the same concept. So God will worry about the miracle, because it's a miracle, right? How does an apple seed become an apple tree? That's a miracle. He says, I understand science can explain all that. That's not what I'm talking about. Right? It's a miracle. Still, the way that nature works is a miracle. So what they say is, God worries about all that. All you got to do is plant the seed. All you got to do is plant the seed and add some water once every other day. Add some fertilizer once a week. And make sure that there's enough sunlight. How difficult is that? Compared to, here's a seed. Get me a tree out of it. You're going to have to hand the guy a genie in a bottle with that. Right? So they say, leave the miracle to God. You work on what you can. You work on the seed. Now, what I'm asking you to do is along this very same concept. Work on the pieces. The grand result, I'm not going to say leave it to God. Leave it to the principle of cause and effect. Because once you've lined up the causes, the effect, even if it wanted to, can't not manifest itself. Do you understand that? Even if the result does not want to manifest itself, right? No, I'm never going to come. I imagine that, like there's some firewood, and there's the oxygen, and there's the heat. Right? You've brought all the requisites for a fire in place. On what planet can fire not Can fire stop itself? Is it the fire god that's going to stop itself from stop the fire from lighting? Can the fire god do that? But, you know, that's where the fire god comes. It's like, how does fire come? It's like, you know, all I did was bring some wood and bring some. You know, there's oxygen in the environment, and all I did was rub a stone against another, and then there was a spark, and all of a sudden there's fire. Where did that come from? So the fire people get, but the how it came, that they don't get. So they say, fire god. Ask me, fire, cause and effect. So, why am I talking about this? To teach you how to light a fire. No. I'm talking about this so we know that, so you understand that what we need to do is work on the specifics. Don't go grand. I'll tell it again, folks. Don't go grand. Don't think big. I know we've spoken in the past, think big. Yes, but it's in a very different context. When we said think big, what we meant there was, you know, don't think big. Think big. Think big. Right? What I meant by that was, you know, have your eye on the prize. Right? There's a bigger goal to be achieved. There's a bigger happiness to be achieved. Right? Don't go for the day-to-day pleasures. Right? Don't settle for so little when you can achieve something so great. When you have the potential, when you have the capacity to go for something so beautiful, something so magnificent. Don't go for something so little. Like, it's not worth an extra serving of ice cream compared to the bliss of Nibbana. It's not something you ought to sacrifice. What? The Nibbana. For the scoop of ice cream. It's not something you ought to sacrifice. So don't think small. Don't think big. Think big. That's what I meant back then. But here what I mean is, it is in a slightly different context. What I mean here is, when you talk about Nibbana, right, think about the specific things. That's why I say, be mindful of your shield. Right? Are you someone who's mindful of your virtues? So don't think, you know, that's got little to do with Nibbana. No, it's got everything to do with Nibbana. It is one who can, with courage and resolve and fight the urge. Right? Because you can't pull a handbrake on the thoughts that come into your mind, because, you know, that comes into your mind from, right, so that's the vipaka world. It comes into your mind. You can't stop that from happening. For that to happen, you need to go through a process of mental cleansing. And that is what the Dhamma does. But the Dhamma does not install in a mind which at the faintest of urges, at the tiniest of urges, you'll just let go. Right? And go and indulge yourself. Either when it comes to desire, aversion, or delusion. So don't give in. That's when you drop your shield. You've got to fight. You're a warrior after all. Veerasa. Savako hamasmi. I'm the disciple of the heroic one. Well, then you got to be a hero if you want to be anything like him. So don't drop your guard. So these are things you can do. As I said, get a list of your get your internet browsing history. If you don't fancy that, I'll give you another one. You can do it with the TV programs you watch. Right, over the course of the next week, whenever you sit down in front of the TV, just make sure, you know, you'll tend to forget. So what you can do is, wherever you sit down, your favorite place to sit down to watch TV, have a piece of paper there with a pen, or some book with your pen on it. So when you flick the TV on and you know, right, this is what I'm going to watch, make a note of the program that you're watching. What would also be useful is just to put the time next to it. What time you started. And then at the end, you can put what time you finished. That's the time you switch off the television. The program was only half an hour, and you realize that you were sat in front of the TV for 3 hours. How do you account for the other 2.5? One, how do you account for the 2.5? And two, how do you account for what is the program that you actually sat down to watch say about you? If you wanna do it, do it a little bit more advanced, take it one step further, what you can do is actually write down the name of all the programs you watched during those 3 hours or 1 hour or whatever time you were sat in front of the TV. And at the end of that, take that with you for your meditation and ask yourself, what does this say about me? Because when you do that now, that gives you an indication of where you are. Gives you an indication of where you are. And then you will be able to identify very specific problems. Once you've identified very specific problems, now you will be able to apply the Dhamma. And that is going to be very powerful. You know, when you... So for those of you who do gardening, right? Some of you might use weed killers. Right? So when you have a weed killer, is it more effective to just spread it all over the place? Or actually go and find out where the weeds are and then, you know, spray or put in a bit of that exactly in the right spot? Which one is more efficient? For which one of these two approaches do you need a little quantity, or a lesser quantity of the weed killer? If you identify the spot very specifically and you apply the weed killer there, then you only need a very specific and very small quantity of it. But if you want to go wholesale, now you're going to need a gallon of it, whereas otherwise you might just need a syringe full of it. Yes or no? I'm coming up with various examples from various situations in life, so you can, you know, find some one that works for you. If you have a rash in your body and you get some ointment, do you apply it all over or do you just apply it on the rash? Which one is more efficient? Which one takes less time? Which one uses up fewer resources? Which one is more effective? That's what I'm saying. Whenever you come to the Dhamma sermon, make this a habit from here on. When you come to a Dhamma sermon, come with a very specific problem. You might have 10 problems, but, you know, come with one. If you have 10, fine, you know, come with 10, but please focus on whichever one you want to work on this week. Like a problem for the week. I focus on that problem for a week. Or the problem of the day, you know, focus it on the day, like the, you know, recipe of the day. I focus on the day. What is the problem you're going to focus on the day? Then you're targeting things very specifically. That is a lot more effective than taking the general approach. Now you're very localized. That is more effective. Fewer side effects also. As in, just in case you're doing the wrong thing. You're doing the wrong thing, then at least your focus is on one very specific thing, and the only thing that can go wrong is that very specific thing, not the whole thing. So, study your week and identify instances in which you let your shield down. Like you're in battle, you have waged war, now's no time to be kidding. Or either you've got to give up. I don't think any of you are in this game to give up. I think you're all here for results. I'm like that, so I think you're the same. So we're here for results. And Guess what? You can all do this. How do I know? I answered that question last week. That's how I know. So I'm not just saying this because it makes you feel better. No, I know it. We can all do this. What matters is that you pick up the courage. You make a resolve and a promise to yourself. Right? You take responsibility for your own well-being, for your own happiness. Like you take responsibility for the well-being of your family, don't you? You take responsibility for the taxation of your car. Right? To make sure your car gets serviced right on time. Right? And waking up in the morning. You don't have someone else come and wake you up, right? You wake up in the morning. You take responsibility for that. I'm saying, when it comes to Nibbana, you've got to take utmost responsibility. One day it's going to be an empty chair. And besides, even if there is a teacher, you know, forever long, the teacher can only encourage you, they can show you the path, but ultimately you're going to have to take responsibility for your own self. So you have to do what you have to do. And I know you're doing it. I'm saying these are other things you can keep adding to that list. You know, there's not 100 million things you need to do. So that's why, you know, every week I sometimes focus on this week let's try and do this. This week let's try and do this. Because I know that in the midst of this, you will find something that really works for you. So that's why a few suggestions. Right? And also I'd like to say on that note, yesterday over the course of the last week we had some responses back from our listeners, as in you guys. Quite a few of you had sent through your homework, if I can call it that. Remember last week I asked you, send me a list of things, you know, 4 to 5 things, ways in which you know you have changed by going through this Dhamma, by really absorbing the Dhamma, the way that your life has transformed. And so thank you. There were a few of you who had actually sent some information through, some details through, and I was really impressed by what I saw. Perhaps on another, maybe in the next sermon, I'll read out a few of them. If I hope you wouldn't mind that. So if there's anything there that you'd rather me not say out loud in a sermon, then just make a note of that when you send this information through, in case any of that is personally identifiable. But I do try and make it as anonymous as I possibly can, because after all, at the end of the day, the intention is not to identify anyone, because there is no one at the end of it. It's simply to identify good practices, good behaviors. And that is really encouraging, because when we listen to others who are able to do things, perhaps sometimes as good as or even better than us, we take lessons from that. How do I take lessons? I take lessons from people who do things better than I do. I learn from them. As much as I learn from other people's mistakes and my own, I also learn from the good of other people. The great that I see in other people. And I'm sure in the things that you send through to me, I will learn things that I can take away into my own life. I am sure of that. And already I have spotted a few of those things. So I think to give it justice, I will, rather than read them out today, I will talk about it in an upcoming sermon. So, well done to those of you who have sent the details through. I was really impressed in reading that, and also in the fact that you actually made the effort to send that information through. If you haven't yet, then of course we still have the time till, you know, you always got time. for as long as I'm here, you can send it through. It's really for us to get an idea of some of the things that, in ways that in which you have your life has changed. It's kind of the stories you come and share with me at the end of the sermons, right? But of course, you don't have the opportunity to do that now. But you know, I just wanted to open up an avenue for you to do that, because I knew that I was able to see that those conversations. I think it really added something to the whole experience of you going in the path of Dhamma, right? I think you know the email address to send that information. It's also in the description on the YouTube video. So, if any of you who's interested in that, by all means send it through, and I will do my best to try and find time to read some of those, and of course I can share some of that with you as well, as I see fit. Okay, so what I want you to focus on, as we have our meditation program next week, but unfortunately it's not going to happen because we have our pirit chanting, which I talked to you about last week. So remember, there's the pirit chanting program next week. It'll start on Saturday evening and will be an overnight program and conclude on the Sunday. And we'll also have the Katina Pinkama alongside that. So any of you who are available that weekend, our invitation goes out to all of you. Join us. You can join us online on our YouTube channel and engage in the meritorious deed. And if I don't remember if I mentioned this last week, and I'll say it again. What those of you who'd like to engage in this in a more active role, what you can do is actually you can get a bottle of water. Perhaps I mentioned this in my last sermon, but I can't remember now. Get a bottle of water and you can have it blessed at home by you chanting the pirit along with us. So it may be you won't be able to do the entire evening throughout the night, but that's fine. I mean, if you have a few people at home, you can take turns, right? Two of you take turns, right? One comes and does it for a couple of hours, and then while the other, so if there's four or five of you at home, then maybe a few others take some rest, and then you come and, you know, you take shifts. And that's how we do it at the monastery also. We have about 60, 70 monks, so everyone, we like to give everyone an opportunity to do it. It's a hugely meritorious deed, so everyone gets a turn. And you can do the same at home. That's what I said last week also, you know, it's only you who can make yourself miss the monastery. Pretty much everything we do here, you can replicate at home to more or less a degree. So whatever opportunities you get, don't let them go. To whatever degree you can engage in them, do it to that degree. You may not be able to go grand, and again, I repeat, there's no need to go grand. Do the small things. Whatever you can do, do it to the best you can. Right? So I think there's real value in you getting involved in that. So you can, while you're at home, get a bottle of water and have it blessed. So get some pirit nool, which you can find in any shop, or perhaps you probably have some at home also. Get some pirit nool and tie one end to not to the Buddha statue, but rather to you can keep one end of it tied to a twig, or usually it comes in some kind of it comes with a certain a holder, but if it doesn't, then just tie it to something, maybe a betel leaf, and place it on the altar where you have the Buddha statue. And the other end, just pull it along, and whoever's chanting the pirit can hold it in their hand and make sure one end, perhaps the original end, in the betel leaf. If you want to have a pirit bottle, you can drop that end into the bottle of water, and then keep that by the Buddha statue at home. So you can do it that way. You can improvise. And what matters is not the exact specifics of the technicalities. What matters is join us. Just do it. And do it to the best you can. And engage and join with us in this meritorious deed, because there's a lot to be gained from that. Okay, so that's going to happen next Sunday, therefore there's not going to be a sermon. But that is no excuse, because I don't like excuses. That is not an excuse for you to not be engaging in your meditation, as I have today in the sermon given you some practical bits of advice and some practical instructions to engage in your meditation sessions. Now, that meditation you do, it does not have to be an hour long. It doesn't have to be 3 or 4 hours long. If you can commit an hour, then actually an hour long might not be a bad idea. But what matters is, get yourself a list, and using any one of the suggestions, one or more of the suggestions I provided before, and go through that and ask yourself, what does this say about me? Is this what I like to be known for? Is this what I want to be? Right? Is this a moment where I drop my shield? And as you do that, you will identify specific problems. Specific problems you will identify. I'll go as far as saying, if you want, well, once you've done this, it's only for people who actually do this, you are welcome to those items where you find as being specific issues. If you want, you can send that through to us. And in one of the future sermons, I will use some of those practical problems you have and try and demonstrate to you how you can apply them into the theory of the Dhamma. Okay, so we can do an actual session like that. So it's really practically helpful for you. But again, I'll only do it if you make the effort yourself and actually do the task that we have asked you to do. And I'm sure you will. So I look forward to hearing the results of some of that. Okay, so on that note then, we will conclude today's sermon. And I think the next sermon will be in a fortnight. But you have your meditation next week, so don't forget that. And we look forward to having some of you with us through the Pirit chanting ceremony event even next week. I will now then hand you over to our Venerable Dasahandru, who will enlighten you about the life of another great elder. This is one who is actually quite a remarkable character, and you will learn as you listen to the story. It is thanks to him we have quite a few of the names that we talk about today. Quite a few of our role models we have today because of this character, because of him. I think that I've probably given too much away, but I'll hand you over to Dasahandru, who will continue with the sermon. And we'll transfer the merits and conclude the sermon at the end. May the Noble Triple Gem be with you all.
Okay. Before we commence, let us take a few moments to worship the Infinite Compassionate One, the Supreme Buddha. So can you all be upstanding and recite the Namaskara with me?
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Okay, you may all be seated. Today we're going to be talking about one of the first few arahats in the Buddha Sasana, the ministry of the Buddha. But first, I would like you all to put yourself in this situation. Let's say, for example, you helped someone at school to prepare for exam. Let's say. And when these results come, the person you helped has a higher mark than you. What sort of feeling bubbles inside your heart? What sort of feeling brews inside yourself? Is it anger? Resent? Fear? Hatred? But is it easy to be in that situation and feel, wow, that guy or that person did well, better than me. I should go and congratulate him. That is much harder. What I say, for example, you're at work and you help a person, their work, who's struggling, and they get a promotion. Or let's say you gave someone a job in the same office or same place as you, and they get promoted. How would you feel? No matter how you felt, Astaji Maharaj Anwanze doesn't do anything. He feels happy for the person. And I'll see why later. So, let's go back in time to the time of the Buddha Padmuttara, 100,000 eons before. So, the great Arhat Astaji was born in a town called Hansavati, in a high caste, surrounded by luxury. But one day he was able to listen to the preachings of the Buddha, and because of that, he became a follower. And he had a determination to attain enlightenment. So just like you and I, the moment we decide we want to attain Nibbana, or the moment we decide we want to do something, we create the causes. So like that, in the previous life of Astaji, he also started to accumulate the causes. So for example, he started to give danas, almsgivings. He started to give, he started to do a lot of merit. Because these were the causes that he could have done for him to become Arhat in this life. Unfortunately, the causes weren't right for him at that moment. So, he was born in the heavens and lived a very heavenly life. But when his lifespan ended, he was born as a human. When that ended, he was born in the heavens again. So, he lived as a human or a heavenly being, a human heavenly being, until just before Prince Siddhartha was born. In the town of Kimbulwatta, in a Brahmin class, which back then was a very high caste, a well-respected high caste, was born a small baby, and he was given the name Astaji. As he grew older, he started to learn the three Vedas, which were scriptures and many other things, and within his youth, he excelled these three. So while this child Astaji was growing, Prince Siddhartha was born. So as we know, after 5 days of his birth, the king announced a naming ceremony. So in this massive palace, the king Siddhartha had found 108 Brahmins who also excelled with the three Vedas. So after giving them food, after attending to their needs, they were ready to name. But out of these 108, there were 8 who were prominent, who were the leaders. And these were the Brahmins called Rama, Jajaya, Lakhana, Mandya, Bhojaya, Suruma, Sudatta, and, as we all know, Kondanya. These were almost the leaders, they were the prominent ones. The people who knew the three Vedas very well. So Prince Siddhartha, the small 5-day-old baby Prince Siddhartha, after being dressed, was given to each of these 8. One by one, they started looking, searching for signs. Each of them finding special signs to show, to prophesize the future of the child. And finally, Sevi came into Kondanya's hand. He also inspected the baby and gave it back. Then after discussing between themselves, each of them held 2 fingers, except one. The 7 who held 2 fingers explained, "O great king, if your child, if the prince, stays in his lay life, he'll become a great king. He'll become a sakra. But, great king, if he decides to ordain, to renunciate, he will become a Buddha." As we all know, the youngest out of the 8, Kondanya. Only had one finger up. He said, "Oh, great king, he will definitely become the Buddha." And explains why he thought so. And after the explanation, all of the 108 Brahmins agreed and said, "Yes, he will become the Buddha." And so they named him with the meaning, spreading artha, or meaning to all. They named him Prince Siddhartha. So each of them, each of these 108 Brahmins, went back home to their families and they called their children over. Maybe have them sat down on their laps and explained, "Oh my children, King Suddhodana has born a son. And the son will become the Buddha, the Supreme Buddha." You can imagine tears appearing in their eyes when they say, "By the time he becomes the Buddha, we will not be alive, we will be dead. But you, my son, you, my daughter, are extremely lucky. Ordain in this dispensation." You can imagine the father, the Brahmin, biting back his tears because by the time Prince Siddhartha becomes a Buddha, they won't be alive. Maybe even flowers may sprout in their grave by the time he becomes a Buddha. But biting back his tears, they urge their children on. "You'll become the Buddha. Ordain under him. Follow his teachings. And liberate yourself." I would like to stop that story there for now. I want you to take that in. That the fathers of these children, the parents of these children, won't be alive at the time when there is a Buddha. Just missed. Think about it. Just one generation. Just missed. But the children are extremely lucky. They have the Buddha, they'll have the Dharma, and they'll have the Sangha. The triple gems. Just think why they're called gems. Gems are rare. They're precious. And they're extremely valuable. The parents of the children just missed it. But what about you? You are also fortunate like these children. Think about it. You also have the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, the triple gem. Think about it. Take a moment to look at everyone who doesn't have this. Take a look at your parents if they've passed away. Take a look at your grandparents if they've passed away. Your great-great-grandparents. Five, six generations before you, they have missed it. They weren't able to listen to the Dharma. Think about it. Out of 8 billion people in this world, you are so lucky enough to see the bullseye. But just seeing the bullseye doesn't work. Doesn't mean you win. All you need to do is take the bow and arrow, pull the string back, and release it straight in the bullseye. Just seeing the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, having them with you doesn't mean you attain enlightenment. You need to go for it. You are born in a very lucky time. You have the triple gems. Use them. Okay, let's carry on then. So slowly, this Prince Siddhartha, grew older, married, and soon after seeing the four great sights, he renunciates, riding on the back of the horse Kantaka, rids himself of all the jewelry, his hair, and dons robes, and becomes the ascetic Gautama. So the news of the renunciation of Prince Siddhartha spread throughout towns and cities. But when it came into the ear of Kondanya, he thought this is the right time to ordain. I can go and follow this ascetic, and when he becomes a Buddha, I will be able to listen to his Dharma. Thinking about his determination, he's now going to ordain to follow this ascetic and help him become the Buddha, so he can liberate himself. But he didn't forget his friends, the other Brahmins. They were not forgotten. So Kondanya went to each and every one of their houses. But all of them had already passed away, had already died. And so he called their children and told them, "Oh children, your fathers have all died. They all died with sadness in their hearts. Now the question is, they died with sadness. Do you want to do as well? Do you want to die with sadness in your hearts as well?" Out of the seven, only four of them joyed. Vapa, Baddiya, Mahanama, and Asaji. And they all joined together and placed Kondanya as their leader. So after they ordained, each of them went as a group to look for this ascetic, look for the ascetic Gautama, looking for the town, the city, the place he's in, to help him, so he can become the Buddha, so he can help them. So from town to town, village to village, each of them roaming to find, just to hear some news. But it didn't take long to hear that he was staying in a forest, practicing extremism. So each of these five went in this forest and trained under him. They also practiced extremism. But most of the time, they helped the ascetic. So the ascetic Gautama would hold his breath, would do various things to harm his body. But then one day he decides, "I'm going to stop eating." So ascetic Gautama starts to reduce his food to the point where his rib cage starts to show. The skin of his chest stuck onto his rib cage. You could see each of these veins. It is said his arms were like bamboos, and the joint, the elbow, was like the ridge. It is said when he touched his stomach, he could feel his spine. The stomach was stuck onto the spine. But every time the Buddha practices extremism, forcing himself not to eat, the five ascetics had only one thought in their mind. Today he will enlighten. Today he will enlighten. Today he will enlighten. I don't think it was very pleasant for them to see this. Don't forget, these are also humans. Imagine you seeing someone who get their ribcage show. They look like they're starving. Are you able to just stand there and look at them? Or do something to help them? But these five ascetics have to fight the urge and help the ascetic. The ascetic Gautama couldn't stand. He would collapse for days. But even when that happens, these five ascetics help him. And every single thought is, he'll enlighten today, he'll enlighten today, he'll enlighten today. The ascetic was very, very close to death. Even when it was obvious that he was going to die, the five ascetics kept thinking, today he will enlighten, today he will enlighten, he will enlighten, he will enlighten. But the ascetic Gautama finally realized, this doesn't work. Extremism doesn't work. I know, I am certain, if I go further, I will die. If I die, I can't enlighten myself. Extremism is in the way. So I will eat. I will now go and eat. So the ascetic Gautama tries to stand up on his two thin, feeble legs, there was like shaking as he props himself up, holding on onto the trees. He tries to walk. Every step he takes, he falls over. His legs can't carry his weight. He's that weak. But he again stands up and tries again. Slowly, he reaches the nearest village and goes round begging for alms. After a few days, his grey skin returns back to its golden colour. And the 32 physical characteristics of the great man, which was all slowly disappearing, started to reform. Soon, he became strong body that he used to have. The five Aztecs were surprised. The five Aztecs thought that it was only through extremism that he'll become the Buddha. And so when they saw the Aztec Gautama eating, and saw the Aztec Gautama with a youthful complexion, they abandoned him, leaving him. He's given up. He's given up on his road, his path to enlightenment. He is no longer wanting to become the Buddha. Let's all go. Let's leave. It's no point helping him now. And they all leave to go to Visivadana in Benares. So Aztec Gautama has stopped extremism and went back to living a normal lifestyle. And it was then where Sujata, the wife of a baron, offered the Aztec Gautama a silver plate of milk rice. So, after consuming the meal, and Sotya, he makes a pillow from soft grass, and on Vesak Poyade, at the age of 35, Aztec Gautama becomes the Buddha. The moment he becomes the Buddha, after 7 weeks, he looked at the roots, the causes of his Buddhahood. Everyone and anyone who helped him, he was determined to help them. So, he first looked at where his teachers are. There are teachers like Alankaram, Buddhagram Buddha, who helped him attain the states of Samadhi. And so that the teachers have passed away and are reborn in the Brahman realms without ears, without the ability of hearing. So there's no point going to them and preaching, because they can't listen to the Dharma. And then he remembered the five Aztecs, who helped him through the 6 years of extremism. Didn't leave him for one moment, and looked with his divine eye where they were, and saw they made their way to Visivadana in Benares. So, from the town, the village that he was in, that was Uruel, to Visivadana, he makes his way by foot. Even though after he attained Buddhahood, he could have made the journey using his supernatural powers, he decides to go from Uruel to Visivadana by foot. On his way there, a man called Upaka sees the Buddha coming from afar and saw that he was different, that this is not a normal person. And Upaka went straight to the Buddha and asked the Buddha, "Oh, Venerable Sir, your features are very pleasant. Every step you take is very radiant. Oh, Venerable Sir, who is your teacher?" And the Buddha explains, "I have eradicated desire, I have eradicated aversion, I have eradicated delusion. I am the Buddha. The pure Dharma is my teacher." And so Upaka asks, "Oh, Venerable Sir, does that mean you're the infinite winner?" "Upaka, I am the infinite winner. I have won the battle of defilements. Oh, Upaka, I'll now make my journey to Visivadana, where I will be preaching for the first time." But Upaka says, "Very well, Venerable Sir," and worships the Buddha and leaves. He was invited to listen to the Dharma, asking if he was the infinite winner, and then leaves. He was this close. If he listened to the Dharma of the Buddha, he may have become a Sotapanna, may have become an Arhat, the first Arhat, but he was even invited to listen to the Dharma. But remember, We cannot change the effect. We can only change the causes. If there wasn't any causes for him to listen to Dharma, then he won't be fortunate enough to listen to it. But don't worry, Upakara does listen to Dharma in the future, but at that moment he wasn't able to. So the Supreme Buddha makes his way all the way to Visipatana, all the way from Uruvel to Benares, to the park that the five ascetics were. And when they saw in the distance that who they thought was still Asti Gautama was approaching them, they all discussed that, look, Asti Gautama is coming. He's returning after failing. Let's not go to him. Let him come to us. Well, let's not respect him because he's obviously lost. He's given up. Let's not do anything for him. Let's not take his alms bowl. Let's not even talk to him. But he is also the son of the king, right? So at least let's make a seat for him. Every step the Buddha took closer to where they were. Every step was filled with infinite compassion. The infinite compassion radiated all the way and filled each of these five or six hearts. The moment when the Buddha was close enough, they had completely forgotten their original plan. One of them ran forward and took his alms bowl. One of them set a place for him to sit. One of them collected some water to wash his feet. After doing all that, and after the Buddha had sat down on the seat that was prepared, each of these people stood around him and asked, "Brother Gautama, monks," said the Buddha, "you cannot call a Buddha brother. I will preach a sermon and you will get rid of all of your suffering, all of your problems. Brother Gautama, I cannot believe that you become the Buddha. You tried for 6 long years of extremism and now you come here telling you're the Buddha. I cannot believe it. You look like you've lived a life of luxury." Ascetics, the Buddha isn't like that. The Buddha isn't a person who seeks luxury. Neither is he a person who experiences extremism. "I will preach a sermon, and if you listen to it, you'll be able to get rid of all your suffering and all your problems. Brother Gautama, I still can't believe that you're the Buddha. How can you be the Buddha? You stopped trying. You failed, remember? That's why you went to eat." But the Buddha replied, "Friends, have I ever told you that I had become the Buddha when I was practicing extremism? Have I ever tricked you just to get something done?" The five ascetics explain, "No, you have neither told us or tricked us in thinking that you are the Buddha." Monks then understand, I have now become the Buddha. Listen to the Dharma and relieve your suffering. So the five ascetics, they thought that it must be true. He's neither tricked us, he's never told us. And so, it must be true. Each of these five ascetics thought that he has agreed that he was the Buddha. And so, each of them sat down on the floor, ready to listen to the sermon, the Dhammacakka Sutra, on the full moon of Esara. By the end of the sermon, Kondanya was a stream enterer, became a Sotapanna, and he was named Anya Kondanya, which meant Kondanya the First. The devas on earth renovated, and the echo of the renovation was heard by the devas in Chatur Maharajika. And so the people the Devas in Chatur Maharaj also renovated. And that was heard, the echoes were heard by thousands. And then, Paranyamana Svati, all the way to the Brahma realms. All the way to Akanikta Brahma realm. The whole place shook. And a light spread throughout the world, filling everyone's heart. At that moment, Kundanya fell onto his knees and begged the Buddha, "Buddha, can you please ordain me?" The other four also, became Sotapannas and also fell onto their knees and also begged for ordination. So each of them, after being ordained, listened to the Buddha and they followed the Buddha all the way to a place of rest where they could rest for the night, where the Buddha preached the sermon of Anantalakkhana Sutra, which explains the essence of this nature, where each of these five ascetics became an arahat, with Kondanya, the Venerable Kondanya, as the first arahat. So that night, there were six arahats in the ministry of the Buddha. And as we know, last time we talked about Venerable Gaudapada, and so we also know about Yasa and Gaudapada and the other 71 arahats, and telling the arahats to spread the Dharma, make sure that no two monks go the same way. And so the Venerable Asaji takes his journey north. Everywhere he go, he preached the Dharma. And everyone who listened to Dharma became a follower of the Buddha, a disciple. And then he went to Rajagaha. There, he went around begging for alms. A young man saw Venerable Asaji and saw his features were very pleasant. He was very calm, tranquil, and moving very slowly. It was such a pleasant sight that this man wanted to talk to the monk. So he followed this monk around until this monk stopped begging for alms, went to the nearest tree and sat down, ready to take his meal. There, this man took his chance and offered some water. And after impatiently waiting for this monk to finish his meal, this man went to the monk and asked, "Oh, Venerable Sir, I am Upadissa. Your features are very pleasant. You're very calm and tranquil. Please, sir, who is your teacher?" Venerable Asaji tells Upadissa, "Young man, I am a follower of the Buddha." And Upadissa sat down and asked, "Venerable sir, can you please tell me something? Please tell me something that this Buddha preaches. What is his teachings?" And Venerable Asaji explains, "Young man, Upadissa, I am very new to this ordained life. I was ordained 2 or 3 days ago. I don't know it all. But I can summarize it in a small phrase." Whereas we all know, he recites, "Ye dhamma hetu pabha, te san hetu tagato aha, te san chayo nirodha, evan vadi maha samana." And after this phrase, Upadissa stood up and said, "Venerable sir, that's enough. That's enough. Where is he? Where is your teacher? I must find him. I must ordain under him. I must follow his teachings. But wait, Venerable sir, I have a friend who I need to tell this to as well. He'll come with me. Venerable sir, let us, the three of us, go together. Let us all go together to meet the Buddha." So as we know, Upadissa went straight to Kolita. No detours. And Kolita, seeing Upadissa approaching him, saw something different, saw a smile that he's never seen before. Quality knew that he has found it. He has found what we've been searching for. And before even Upadesa opened his mouth, Quality exclaims, "You have found it, haven't you? You look very different, oh great friend. You have found it." And Upadesa explains, "Yes, I have found it." And Upadesa recites the stanza, and Quality also becomes a Sotapanna. And Quality exclaims, "We have found what we've been searching for. Where is our teacher? Who is our teacher? Our teacher is the Buddha. Come, come with me. Let us go and meet our teacher." So as we know, these two friends go to their old teacher and explain that they found what they've been looking for, and explains that, tells the teacher to come with them, and as we know, he doesn't. And so these two, taking another 150 friends, went to see the Buddha. And they all ordained under him. Now remember the start where I told you to put yourself in the situation of someone getting high marks or a promotion that you don't? Now, there came a day where the Buddha gave honorary titles. So first he gave one to Anya Kondanya, and then he gave one to Venerable Sariputta, and then one to Venerable Mahamoggala. Now, as we know, Venerable Asaji was Venerable Sariputta's teacher. He was the one who gave Venerable Sariputta the Dharma. He is the one who helped him. But he was promoted after his student. But he wasn't surprised. He didn't feel any hatred, remorse, anger. It was almost like it was normal. He had no feelings towards it. Now imagine you're the one who's promoted. How would you act? But Venerable Sariputta didn't act like that. No matter what, Venerable Sariputta respected Venerable Asaji. He'll first attend the Buddha, and then he'll go secondly straight to Venerable Asaji. Now, one day, in the night, just before Venerable Sariputta fell asleep, other monks saw Venerable Sariputta worshipping two directions, and he slept in a certain direction as well. He never slept in another one, just this one direction. And so, many monks were confused. Oh, the chief disciple, our chief commander, Venerable Sariputta is still following the ideas of Brahmins. He's still worshipping directions. So they went to the Buddha, asked the Buddha, "Your chief disciple, Venerable Sariputta is worshipping direction. He still is following the ideas of Brahmins." And so the Buddha called Venerable Sariputta and asked him, "Sariputta, are you still following ideas of Brahmins?" But Venerable Sariputta knew that the Buddha knew. The Buddha knows why he is worshipping, what he is worshipping. And so he replies, "Oh Venerable Sir, I know that you know. So please, out of compassion to all of us, explain." And so the Buddha replies to the gathering, "O monks, Venerable Sariputta doesn't worship the directions. He worships his two teachers, me and Venerable Asaji. And as you say, he sees in certain direction is because he never puts his feet in the direction of his teachers." Remember, Venerable Sariputta also knew his roots. He never forgot about them. What is a tree without its roots? Even in the smallest breeze, a tree without roots will topple over. But Venerable Sariputta, he knew his roots. He knew that he needed the roots to grow. He didn't let his teachers go. Now the question is, do you still remember your roots? Do you still remember the person who gave you the Dharma? The person who gave you the CD? The person who gave you the YouTube link? The person who told you that, "Look, on Sunday we'll listen to this English sermon. Do you want to come with us?" Do you still remember those people? What about your partner who said, "You go, I'll look after the children, I'll do the housework, you go and listen to the Dharma"? Or the one who readied your clothes for you, or gave you food? Do you still remember them? Do you still remember your roots? Because Venerable Asaji knew his roots. The Buddha knew his roots. Venerable Sariputta knew his roots. Do you see that's something similar between all these great people? Do you respect, do you remember your roots? it's not only the people who helped you with the Dharma. What about the people? What about your nursery teacher? Your teacher from preschool? Without them, would you be who you are? Do you remember your roots? And also, are you a person who can represent your teacher? What I mean by that is, do you see, Venerable Asaji was just walking or going around for alms in the kingdom of Rajagaha, and a random young man came up to him and asked, your teachers are very pleasant, you're so calm and tranquil, who is your teacher? He was someone who represents his teacher. He was someone who his teacher can say, that is one of my followers. He is a disciple, he's one of my disciples. Can the Buddha, can your teacher say that he's my student? Or do they have to say that after hiding their face? What do you think? Are you someone who could be worn, who could be used as an example? Or are you someone who can only be hidden away? Are you someone who can represent your teacher? Would someone go up to you and ask you who your teacher is? Not only Venerable, the Buddha was also like that, remember? Upakaka went to the Buddha and asked who his teacher was. So, can you represent your teacher? Can your teacher say proudly say, this is my student? If not, then be someone like that. Be like Venerable Asaji. Be someone who represents his teachers. That the Buddha one day go and say, you're one of my disciples. Can you represent your teacher? Right. That brings us to the end. So, before we end, let's take a few moments to transfer all the merits we've accumulated. So let's take a moment to transfer the merits we've all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, chanting period, listening to the Dharma, and engaging in various meritorious deeds today. So first and foremost, let's remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And with immense gratitude, let us transfer these merits to the Bhikshu Bhikshunis, Upasakas, Upasakas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teaching of the Buddha, and passed it down to generations and noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, to understand, to comprehend. Let us all take a moment to transfer the merits we have acquired to all the members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the priests, the chief prelates of all the chapters, who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and committed themselves to the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that among them are the monks and nuns within your local temple and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to Guru Sai Nuan and all the other monks resident in the monastery, and as well as the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits and express our gratitude to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Lord Buddha, be that by transitory these sermons, sharing them out with others, inviting others to join them, may to the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of the merits, may they refrain from their meritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble before path and attain supremacy in Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us take a moment to transfer merits we require to our devotees, friends of the monastery, who for sake of merits continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes every one of you who have contributed to the construction of the monastery, to those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes, medicines, as well as those of you who pass on their know-hows, extend their well-wishes. May the power of the merits, may they abstain from their meritorious deeds, fulfill their meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble effort, path and attain the supreme Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us take a moment to transfer merits to mothers, fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons, daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews, nieces, our elders, friends and acquaintances, employers, employees, and to all those who have helped us, supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form. By the power of their merits, may they be healed of any physical or mental ailments, and overcome any obstacles in their spiritual progress, may they abstain from their meritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain supreme bliss nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's all take a moment to transfer merits to the devas, brahmas, spirits, demons, primarily the Sakrodeva, as well as numerous gods and deities, who are committed to protect and fulfill the Sambhu Buddha Sasana. Let's all take a moment to transfer merits to our guardian deities, who keep watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May the power of the merits, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom, may they abstain from their meritorious deeds, fulfill their meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain supreme bliss nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's all take a moment to transfer merits to our ancestors who precedes us, to all those who have been our friends, families, acquaintances in this infinitely long journey to Sansara, and those who have helped us, supported us, assisted us in any way they could, let's transfer these merits. Let Thus also transferred the merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, and all those who lost their lives in war, be their friend or foe, rejoice in the merits required today. Thus also transfer merits to all those who have lost their lives in natural calamities such as tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides, pandemics, reminding ourselves among them will be those who have been our friends and family to us in this long journey to Sansara. Thus take a moment to transfer merits to them. May the power of the merits, if any of them have been born with a plane, may they redeem themselves and be born in the Supreme. May they abstain from their meritorious deeds, fulfill their meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble foot path and hit the Supreme Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Finally, let us all resolve, may the power and blessing of all the merits we acquire throughout the day, we bear witness the event of many hundreds of thousands of arhats on this blessed land. And finally, may to the power of all the men who are today, you and I and everyone who made this program success, be an Arhat Nivasi, or Arhat Main Nivasi, in this very life, in the era of Gautam, Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessing of the noble Chopra Gem be with you all. We now conclude the Samadhi.